conscience represents ethics that I feel are not socially constructed and not socially learned, but built in. In fact, the whole of psychoanalysis is grounded in such an ethic. We all, as analysts, prefer value life over death. We value truth over lies. We value love over hate, kindness over cruelty, as do those little three-month-old kids that Bloom studied at Yale. These values are, I would say, grounded in our biology. I think they are a part of what Winnicott would call our true self. And they're quite distinct from the very different moral notions that wind up in our superego. After all, the superego contains our racism. It contains our sexism. It contains our heterosexism. It contains all of that stuff. And that stuff, those values, are very distinct from these core values, love over hate, life over death. We all know, on a fundamental level, we all know what's right and what's wrong on that very basic level. And that's the voice of conscience. We don't need God for this. It's built in biologically.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking, not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Don Carvith. This is my second interview with Don Carvith, and it's in acknowledgement of a new monograph of his that just came out called Guilt, A Contemporary Introduction. And it is an intentionally brief monograph of 68 pages. And in it, he brings forward his really deeply thought out ideas about the difference between the superego, which he sees as primitive and derived from the persecutory position, from the conscience, which he sees as mature, related to the depressive position, and fundamentally object related. We unpack this, we discuss it in relation to clinical matters, we discuss it in relation to political matters, and we close with his sharing his passionate feelings and concerns about our field and the direction he sees it going. It's a pleasure to talk to Don again. He is an emeritus professor of sociology and social and political thought at York University in Toronto. He is a training and supervising analyst in the Canadian Institute of Psychoanalysis. He's a past director of the Toronto Institute, past editor-in-chief of the Canadian Journal of Psychoanalysis, and he's the author of The Still Small Voice, Psychoanalytic Reflections on Guilt and Conscience, Psychoanalytic Thinking, A Dialectical Critique of Contemporary Theory and Practice, and as I say, the recently published Guilt, A Contemporary Introduction. I learn something every time I read Don's work and we have a conversation. He shares with us not only all the things I mentioned, but we also spend some time on his religious evolution in his life and how that relates to the subject at hand. It's a fascinating time, and I hope you enjoy it as well. Don, welcome back to the podcast. It's so good to have you here again.
Good to be here with you, Harvey.
Don, you and I first spoke back in February 21, which of course feels like a lifetime ago. And at that time, we discussed your thinking and your clinical findings about the important difference between persecutory guilt and reparative guilt. And you have continued to develop your thinking, and just very recently, you've come out with a monograph on the subject, which gives me occasion to speak to you again. It's called Guilt, A Contemporary Introduction. It's really a marvelous read. It's 68 pages, and it's tight, concise, very clear, and to the point. And one of the additions you make in this writing is that you also bring in the culture that we now live in, and how that culture, especially the political culture, is reflective of this persecutory state of mind, which we will get to. But I want to start us off by reading from the preface. And you write, quote, "A major reason for our moral confusion in both society and psychoanalysis is the failure to recognize the existence of a conscience apart from the moralistic, socially constructed superego. Taught to maintain neutrality and refrain from being judgmental or superego-ish with patients, without a concept of a conscience distinct from superego, theory succumbs to the colonization of morality by the superego, and clinicians fall victim to moral relativism. Without a conscience separate from the superego, we have no judge to judge the judge." Start us off. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, I guess I encountered this first in my prior training as a sociologist. The cultural relativism of the field, the idea that there is morality A on this side of the mountains and morality B on the other side of the mountains, but there was never any way of asking the question, which of these moralities is more moral or the true morality? I was bothered by this relativism for very many years. And then when I trained as an analyst, I found that the very same problem existed. You can only critique one superego from the standpoint of another superego. So for a long time, I thought that in a world without God, I mean, prior to secularization, you had the Vox Dei, the voice of God, and you could critique different social moralities from the standpoint of a non-social morality, a morality not socially constructed, but grounded in God. But if you don't believe in God, then you lose that opportunity to have a point from which to critique different moral systems. But today, that is no longer a problem. I'm going out of my way in this book to write it in a secular, completely secular language. And I say in the book that, in my opinion, we do not need God to be good. There is growing evidence that conscience, as distinct from superego, superego being the social constructed moral systems, but we do have a conscience and it's grounded biologically. The animal research shows that animals, primates, are much more social and altruistic with one another and sacrificing one for another. And Bloom's research at Yale shows that little kids as young as 3 months of age already know right from wrong. So you can either ground conscience as a separate structure of the mind in addition to id, ego, superego, conscience, and perhaps ego ideal. Then we would have a five-structure model. But increasingly, I'm inclined to ground conscience in the id of all places, because we've had a very biased attitude towards the id. We've thought of the id as the source of antisocial impulses. But the id is also, if we talk about the id as the biologically loaded structure of the mind, the id is loaded with pro-social impulses.
Let me interrupt you there, because I want to make sure, having read your work for some time, I'm very familiar with your thoughts, but start us off by distinguishing what you mean by conscience versus superego and its implications for how we understand ourselves, our patients, and how we think clinically, given our situation of being faced by one or the other of those.
Okay. So conscience represents ethics that I feel are not socially constructed and not socially learned, but built in. In fact, the whole of psychoanalysis is grounded in such an ethic. We all, as analysts, value life over death. We value truth over lies. We value love over hate, kindness over cruelty. These are, as do those little three-month-old kids that Bloom studied at Yale. These values are, I would say, grounded in our biology. I think they are a part of what Winnicott would call our true self. And they're quite distinct from the very different moral notions that wind up in our superego. After all, the superego is... it contains our racism. It contains our sexism. It contains our heterosexism. It contains all of that stuff. And that stuff, those values are very distinct from these core values, love over hate, life over death. We all know on a fundamental level, we all know what's right and what's wrong on that very basic level. And that's the voice of conscience. We don't need God for this. It's built in biologically.
And the other distinguishing feature that you emphasize is one is other-related, conscience is other-related, and superego is narcissistic, which
yes.
has a great deal to do with how it presents in our office.
Yeah, superego is narcissistic, as is the whole paranoid schizoid position, to go to Melanie Klein. Life in the paranoid schizoid position is narcissistic, and the superego is based on an identification with a persecutor, and we feel persecuted in the paranoid schizoid, and we don't have time to think of others because it's all about survival of the self. When we move into the depressive reparative position, conscience kicks in. Winnicott's capacity for concern for the other kicks in. So, yeah, conscience is oriented towards others. Superego is very narcissistic.
The way you write about it is also very clear. You say, it is commonly thought that guilt is a useless and harmful emotion that we should get rid of. But that applies only to persecutory guilt, which is utterly narcissistic, self-involved, and irrelevant to the needs of the injured party.
Yes.
In reparative guilt, we manage to get our minds off ourselves long enough to take note of the needs of the injured other and to make reparation.
Yes.
That's a big deal.
That is a very big deal. I mean, Freud thought that civilization, because we have to repress antisocial tendencies to live together in civilization, that this repression of the antisocial was going to be leading up to a buildup of guilt in civilization, but it was only persecutory guilt that he had in mind. Civilization needs less persecutory guilt. He was right about that, but it needs a lot more reparative guilt.
And you make the point, which has a great deal to tell us about treatment, that at times persecutory guilt is used as a defense against conscience and concern for the other.
Yes.
Tell us more about that, because that really, it lives every day in our office.
Yeah, for sure it does. And I find it, I've always found it astonishing that people will choose to spend their lives in having essentially an orgy of self-persecution. They prefer that to admitting that they're bad, that they have a bad side. I mean, in the culture of narcissism, admitting that you're bad is like felt to be like the worst thing. I mean, people have to go around polishing their images and to admit that you are a flawed human being, that you have done wrong, that you have been a bad guy in certain ways, also a good guy, not to split it. But some people find it almost impossible to admit that they have been at fault, their wrongdoing. And so instead, I mean, if you don't go that way and admit your faults and make reparation, you're going to spend your life persecuting yourself one way or another, psychosomatic illnesses, relationships in which you get people to beat you up one way or another, because you're going to have a need for punishment because you're not acknowledging your faults. Yeah, it seems very masochistic, a preference for self-persecution to simply owning up to one's faults.
Now, it seems to me that when you say that people will act out at times their whole lives, their need for punishment rather than their concern for the other, it sounds to me like you're introducing an aspect that to care about another person is riskier for the person than it is to be narcissistically preoccupied with self-abuse. And so that leads one as a clinician to wonder, what is their life history of caring for others and or being cared for by others that is so fraught that staring in the mirror and hating yourself is preferential?
Well, your question is reminding me of that wonderful essay by William Singletary. He's a colleague of yours in Philadelphia.
Yes.
He wrote that paper on Pinocchio. It's a brilliant paper, not only for its interpretation of Pinocchio as an allegory of development, but in that paper, he talks about a very disturbed child who climbed up in the closet and was throwing himself from a high point, and he would have probably broken his neck, but Singletary grabbed him. And the kid's response to being saved was to spit in Singletary's face. And then later, Singletary talks about an interpretation he gave to that boy, or perhaps to another child. You know, I think, he says, when it's your feeling more loving towards mummy, that's when you want to kick her.
Right.
Okay, so I found that to be very important clinically, that sometimes patients are so threatened by loving feelings that they go on the attack.
And that includes feeling loved as well.
Fearing love.
And feeling being on the receiving end of love.
Yes. You see it both ways. I mean, I have a patient who has a very loving wife, but he cannot accept compliments or any kind of gestures of love and appreciation. She writes him a card for his birthday. And, you know, he reads the card and he's a bit stunned standing there reading this loving stuff. And when she's not looking, he folds the card and kind of puts his hands behind his back and lets it fall into the wastebasket. He can't take delivery on love and compliments.
And we see that in the transference as well, all the time.
Yeah.
Which, speaking about the history of affectionate relations or otherwise in people's lives, this brings us to the topic of trauma, about which you have a good deal to say. Now, on the one hand, you speak of the degree of trauma that one finds in the history of people who are narcissistically preoccupied with self-abuse. So we know that's true. But you also write, you say, usual psychoanalytic matters have been displaced in favor of a preoccupation with trauma, abuse, deprivation, and environmental failure, the ways we are, and now you brilliantly quote Lear when he says, more sinned against than sinning.
Yes.
So help us understand these two facets of your thoughts about trauma.
See, I think the gold of psychoanalysis is in Freud's and the early Freudians' work on unconscious guilt, the need for punishment, self-sabotage, clutching defeat from the jaws of victory. For me, as I've matured as a clinician, and this is surprising because I started out as quite a rebel against Freud. I went for all the revisionist things, object relations, self-psychology, relational psychoanalysis, even flirted with Lacan for quite a while. Because, you know, part of me is quite critical of Freud, but also very admiring of him. But as time has gone on, my admiration for that early work on unconscious guilt, I think it's the gold. And I think that psychoanalysis for 60 or 70 years since the 1950s has been turning away from this and marginalizing it. And has, I mean, that early work shows how patients unconsciously contrive to refine and intensify their childhood suffering. Right. Okay, it's a deeply masochistic process. It's part of the unconscious compulsion to repeat. Well, that's been lost sight of. We've moved into a discourse of victimization. Now, of course, there are victims. There is abuse. There is trauma. There is injustice. I'm not questioning the reality of the trauma and the environmental failure. Not at all. But what I am saying is that trauma and neglect lead to rage. And many of the newer perspectives in psychoanalysis seem to have overlooked this point, that trauma makes for rage. Now, where is the rage going to go? It's, of course, going to be turned back on the self. The kid can't afford to displace his rage outwards. That will just make him more punished, more abandoned. So he turns it on himself, and now we're into deep self-persecution and masochism, and we've got all kinds of problems. But the rage that's turned on self has been lost sight of. I think part of the reason I'm writing this book is to try to remind us of these core Freudian and Kleinian insights that I think in relational psychoanalysis and so on, we've gotten a long way. Now, I'm not saying, I mean, some colleagues have hung on to this. I'm not the only one. Sure. Some colleagues have hung on to these early Freudian Kleinian insights, but there's been an evasion of guilt. It's not just our patients who evade guilt. Psychoanalysis because psychoanalysis is part of the culture. And it is a culture of narcissism. And the last thing a narcissist wants to face is his guilt. And so psychoanalysis has turned away from guilt and is evading guilt just as the culture is evading guilt.
You make the distinction between sympathy and empathy, but you make it differently than most others do. Share with us how you think of each of those.
Well, because I've worked with a few psychopaths and they're highly empathic. By empathy, I mean the cognitive act of putting yourself in the other person's shoes. They're so good at that. They know exactly what words you need to hear coming out of their mouths to get you to reach your wallet and open it and take the money out of it and hand it to them. Mm-hmm. So they're highly empathic. Okay, but they're utterly unsympathetic. They don't give a damn. So a decent human being has to have empathy, but empathy can be used psychopathically. You have to go beyond empathy to sympathy, which is what Winnicott meant by the capacity for concern, the capacity to care about the welfare of the other.
And by that, you don't simply mean pity the other.
No, I mean responsibly want to help them.
I hear you.
To heal them.
You know, one of your quotes in the book that really touched me was one that may be familiar mostly to Americans listening to this and maybe Americans of a certain age. But we had a demagogue in this country back in the 50s named Joe McCarthy, and he destroyed many people's lives.
Yes.
And finally, at long last, there was a senator, Joseph Welch, who stood up to him very famously, and he said, "Sir, have you no decency?"
Yes.
And that was the end, the beginning of the end of Joe McCarthy, because that moment in time and that phrase of decency catalyzed the country, because it brought to people's attention the absence of decency, something we can certainly need to note nowadays as well. But decency is such a good parallel phrase for conscience.
Yes. I mean, I was 10 years of age watching with my dad. We'd only had a TV for a couple of years. We were watching that on TV, and I was so impressed by Welsh. I'm even more impressed now. You have assassinated this lad enough, Senator. You have done enough. Have you no sense of decency? Wow. Standing up to a bully like that and calling him out. But it's the particular kind of bully who cloaks himself in morality. I mean, we're seeing this all over the place these days. Bullies who, as I would say, taking a phrase from my mentor, Eli Sagan, marching under the banner of the superego. These are people clothed in righteousness, and they are sadistically attacking others the way McCarthy was attacking people. And it's very hard to stand up to these moralistic people who are full of righteousness, but they need to be confronted. They need to be called out as the sadists that they often are.
We're going to get to the cultural aspect in a minute. I want to spend a little bit of time specifically on the clinical manifestations and how it appears in your office and how you think about it and how you intervene, how the trajectory of treatment is impacted by your understanding of these two developmental levels.
I think a lot of people in our culture, and we've touched on this already, they think of moral values, superego, as something generated by religion, by churches, by school principals, by cops. They're skeptical of it. They see it as arbitrary. They see it as socially constructed. They know that in other countries, the laws and the norms are very different. So they don't think of these moral values as anything other than humanly constructed, and they're ironic and skeptical about them. And that's useful because they can... That frees them up to violate the rules when the rules pinch and they don't want to be pinched by the rules. I mean, it's not as if they're violating the laws of God. They're just violating the laws of the vice principal of the school, and he's an idiot anyway. So this attitude towards rules leads a lot of people to justify their acting out. And they often are acting out. So I have a series of patients, guys who are cheating on their wives, cheating on their taxes, benefiting from things that have, quotes, fallen off the back of the truck, engaged in very questionable business practices. And they know they're violating rules, but they have contempt for the rules. And they don't understand that there is another set of rules called conscience. This is a different set of rules. This set of rules is not socially constructed. It doesn't require God to have this other set of rules. These are built in. And even the most severely psychopathic, they do have a conscience. It used to be thought that they lack a superego and that they certainly lack a conscience. No. They have both, but they're just very good at putting them out of operation. They know how to silence the superego, and they know how to silence the conscience. But they do have a conscience. And so clinically, what I do is I wait around, and I don't moralize, but I wait around until I start to see the consequences of these violations of conscience. Every time you cheat on your wife, it seems within a day or so the migraines are back. I see every time you engage in that illegal business practice, pretty soon you're getting into a horrible fight with your wife or whatever, and you're suffering, or you have an accident and you break your leg or your arm. Isn't it curious? It seems that there's something in you that seems to disapprove of these practices. Okay, that's the way I go about it. I'm trying to point out to them that they do have a conscience and that they are punishing themselves for their violations of it.
But they will likely hear that as coming from a moralistic superego primitive position, no?
Well, I've learned a lot from August Acorn, who was Heinz Kohut's analyst. He, Wayward Youth, you know, Freud wrote the introduction to his book. He was also, I think, a mentor of Hyman Spotnitz. And the way he dealt with delinquents was to dress a little bit like them, speak a little bit like them. So I do a bit of that. I don't come on moralistically at all. I show a certain amount of defiance of the normative order. I'm not very identified with the authorities because the authorities are often corrupt anyway. I can come on a little bit like a bad boy myself. And so that kind of prevents them from seeing me as a priest-like or cop-like figure, you know? So I distance from that. And I also play a little dumb. I play a little naive. Like, isn't it curious? Every time you cheat on your wife, these migraines come back. What do you think about that? I mean, I'm playing a little naive there, you know, because I'm really trying to avoid at all costs sounding like the moralistic superego. Because if I go there, the game is up.
Sure.
Because once he's able to put me in the position of the moralist, then he's not discovering the inner moralist within him. He's projected it all onto me now. My job is to prevent that from happening so that he can begin to discover that there is a moralist alive and well in him.
You're inviting him to observe how his mind works.
Yes.
Which is traditional defense analysis, yeah?
Yes, exactly.
You know, it is said, of course, that children's superego develops not from what their parents say, but from their own unconscious superego. And in a sense, that's what you're saying, that you're representing yourself not as a moralistic person, but a little bit of a rebel with decency, to use that word. And that's what your patients, you're saying, are picking up from you.
I think patients, even the pretty deeply psychopathic ones, I think they want an analyst who's decent. I think they want an analyst who has a conscience. They won't ever say so. But when they see glimpses of the fact that you are conscientious, that you don't violate the rules, that you maintain the frame of the treatment, when they overpay you, you pay them back. you deal with them very fairly and so on. They kind of admire that. And
identify with it.
And they come to identify with it. This is why it's so terrible for analysts to engage in certain kinds of shady business practices, like up here, extra billing beyond. My medical colleagues are covered in Canada by socialized medicine, but they used to be allowed to extra bill $20 or $50 an hour on top of what the government pays. That was banned by the government, but some of the colleagues have gotten lawyers and they found sneaky ways of getting around it. And they're still extra billing in sneaky ways. That's really terrible because the patients are going to identify with that and they're going to find all kinds of sneaky business practices too.
So let's talk about our culture. Speaking of whether it be Canada, the US or anywhere, you write, although generally found on opposite sides of the political spectrum, today the narcissistic sociopathic types on the right are joined on the pseudo-left by the normopaths who reproach, condemn, and seek to cancel, i.e. destroy, those they judge immoral, politically incorrect, or otherwise, quote, beyond the pale. Tell us about this on the right and the left.
Well, both are narcissistic. Both sides are against regulation. I mean, the society for 50 years has moved towards deregulation, neoliberalism, privatization, and psychoanalysis has followed suit. Psychoanalysis has lost touch with the regulators, namely superego and conscience. In 1960, It was Sandler in England pointed out that analysts were no longer organizing their clinical material around superego and guilt issues. Arlo in the 90s made exactly the same point. Wormser in 1998 said the superego is the sleeping giant of psychoanalysis. We turned away from it. So people on the right are turning away from regulation. They don't want regulators. Hence, we got the 2007-2008 economic crisis. People on the pseudo-left, I distinguish it from the real left. I consider myself a man of the left. As a sociologist, I'm a theoretical Marxist. I'm not a Marxist-Leninist, but I'm a Marxist insofar as I think Marx had a lot to say about how society works. But the pseudo-left has very little to do with Marxism anymore. It's all identity politics. And, those people are also attacking regulation and regulators. They called to defund the police. Well, that's to remove regulation. The police, like the superego and the conscience, are regulators. Of course, the people on the right don't want the police either. They're busy getting around the law, even in the highest offices of the land. There is flouting of the law. And then on the pseudo-left, there's flouting of the law, the burning of police stations, calling for defunding of the police, and so on. I mean, on both sides, there is resistance to conscience and to law.
It's that elusive quality of decency, yeah?
Yes, yeah. Yes. And self-limitation, the ability to say no to yourself. I mean, to be the authority to yourself, to say, look, this is wrong. I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to allow myself to go there. This is a bit of a lost art in the culture of narcissism, to set limits on oneself.
Don, I think you have used the word God in our conversation today more than any other person I've interviewed. Uh-huh. And that's in your book as well.
Right.
And fill us in on what leads you to use it, because you use it, you refer to it, and you also dismiss it and say you move beyond. So tell us more about your thinking about this.
Okay. Well, so look, I was raised in the Episcopal Church, and I was kind of a devout boy until I discovered girls and masturbation, and then I lost it all. And my dad had Bertrand Russell's Why I'm Not a Christian in his library, and that finished it off. It came back in my 40s, and so I've been struggling with it for many years. And here I find the Kleinian theory very helpful. When I'm in the depressive, reparative, mature position, I do not believe in God. I do not believe in a supernatural God. I'm an enlightenment rationalist and a scientist, and I hate woo-woo magical thinking. I want none of it. So that's me when I'm functioning in the mature position. But when I'm going in for surgery, I'm praying. And when I wake up from surgery, I'm praying. And in the room beside me was a whole village of people speaking, praying in Arabic. The baby, the grandparents, they were all there. And I wake up from morphine and they're praying and I'm feeling, oh my God, this is wonderful. I'm so happy they're there. I don't know what they're saying. But so when I'm under threat, I can become an evangelical Christian. But as soon as I'm recovering, it goes back. I'm back in the mature position, and all of that religious stuff is now metaphor. Now, I find it to be very useful metaphor. The whole of liberal theology understands the Bible and the New Testament as metaphor. And that's very rich and useful, but I'm a guy who fundamentally is an atheist or at least an agnostic. Now, in my earlier books, I let some of my involvement with Christianity be known. But I set out in this book to keep it out. You're saying it snuck in anyway. to some extent, but I wanted to keep it out because I don't want to lose my readers. If I'm seen as preaching a Christian message of some kind, my readership is mostly gone, especially among analysts who are mostly atheists. So I don't think I'm trying to hide something. I just don't want to alienate my readers. So I went out of my way in this book to say, you do not need God to be good. I'm grounding conscience not in the Vox Dei, but in something we share with our primate cousins and in something that we develop in early identification with those who kept us alive by feeding us and loving us. So that's what conscience is for me. I'm increasingly moving in that direction. I don't think we need religion to address these psychoanalytic issues of guilt, superego, conscience. We can cover this very well and very thoroughly in a completely secular language.
Speaking of your evolution, where do you see yourself as an analyst going, and or where do you see the field going in the upcoming years, if not generation? Where would you like it to be in 10, 20 years?
Well, I think we're in trouble right now, serious trouble, but I see this new trouble around so-called CSJT, critical social justice theory, which is tearing the American Psychological Association and the American Psychoanalytic Association, tearing apart. They're forcing the president to resign, and it's a terrible situation. But I see this is not terribly new. I think the foundation for this has been laid over the last 50 or 60 years. Beginning in the 1950s, core Freudian and Kleinian insights into things like unconscious guilt and the need for punishment, that has been marginalized. And we moved into relational psychoanalysis, interpersonal psychoanalysis, self-psychology, intersubjectivity. Those developments of the last 50 years have laid the foundation because they present a socially constructivist model of personality. People in those schools don't want to know too much about the unconscious. They don't really, they're all about attuning empathically to the patient's more or less conscious and preconscious experience. Borderline patients don't want you to address anything that has to do with their unconscious. And many analysts think that interpreting the unconscious to a patient is a kind of psychological rape, imposing our theories on the patient. So work on the unconscious has been marginalized already for decades in psychoanalysis. This latest assault by critical social justice theory is simply a follow-up and a deepening of, well, maybe they want to do away with the Freudian, Kleinian understanding of the human psyche. They want to have a view of the psyche as entirely a social product. I've been fighting that all my life because as a graduate student, I was encountering that in sociology. My mentor, Dennis Wrong, who taught New York University for his whole career, he wrote this classic article in 1961 called The Over-Socialized Concept of Man in Modern Sociology. He was a very rare thing in 1960. He was a psychoanalytically oriented sociologist. I mean, at that time, sociology and psychoanalysis merged like oil and water. They just didn't mix. But I found this one guy who actually was a Canadian. He was the son of his father was the Canadian ambassador to Washington. He grew up in Washington, and then he came back to school in Canada. But he wrote this article, and I was then able to write a PhD dissertation rejecting social determinism, sociological reductionism, defending the idea of a psyche and of forces within the child that are capable of resisting socialization. I mean, the sociologists were writing as if the child is entirely clay to be shaped by society. As if there's nothing in the child that fights back against socialization pressures, which any parent understands is completely incorrect. So this is not a new drift towards the social. marginalizing the existence of a relatively autonomous psyche that resists social pressure. Look, even Karl Marx believed in a universal human nature. People don't know this about him. Erich Fromm knew that and followed Marx. Marx distinguished a universal human nature that expresses itself differently in different social and historical circumstances, but he did not reject the idea of a universal human nature or a universal human psyche. I mean, Fromm posited a universal human psyche with universal needs, needs for orientation and devotion, needs for relatedness, and so on. So we are not entirely social products. And so CSJT is really pushing this now. But, in the 1960s, some feminists had engaged in intensive consciousness raising. And having done all of this consciousness raising, they found that they were still victims of patriarchal ideology. Like they might only be able to get attracted to a very sexist, domineering man. People like Juliet Mitchell looked at that and said, okay, apparently we're going to need some unconsciousness raising. And they turned to psychoanalysis. That is exactly what's going to happen with the CSJT people. They're going to do all of this identifying their positionality vis-a-vis race and gender and all of the rest. They're going to do their intersectionality, okay? But that's not going to eliminate their obsessions, their compulsions, their addictions, their perversions, their depression, their anxiety. They're going to go looking for a psychoanalyst. So I'm not afraid that analysis will disappear. People who have problems of the soul are always going to look for soul doctors. But in the meantime, it's going to do a lot of damage to the institutions of psychoanalysis. It's already damaging them, but they've already been damaged. We've not been teaching core psychoanalysis very well. I mean, I can't speak for other institutes. We try our best in Toronto, but I don't know how well we've been doing. We try, but a lot has been lost.
Don, you have given us so much to think about. Both the content and your passion is really inspiring. Your thoughtfulness about these differences in how the mind works, that you're distinguishing between the superego and the conscience, and especially I find you're underlining the use of persecutory guilt to defend against caring about the other and being cared for by the other, right? is really a seminal thought, and it has deep application in the office on a daily basis. And your observations about the effort of many in our field to turn away from the gifts we've been given by our teachers originally, not that we have to stop at that, no, but we need to build on it as opposed to reject it, baby and bathwater both. Yeah. And I think that is really a take-home message and the start of many rich conversations. Don, always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us again.
Always a pleasure, Harvey. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.